The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Loves it. He is a vampire at heart. We thank you, Colonel Kirk. Kirk Schlichter, take it away.
Thank you, Hugh Hewitt. I am Kirk Schlichter, senior columnist at townhall.com. Noted Los Angeles trial lawyer. I am a retired United States Army colonel. I am the author of the forthcoming Regnery book, We'll Be Back, The Fall and Rise of America, which you must pre-order unless you want to die unloved and alone. Hugh missed it. By that much. That's right. Hugh missed the glorious opening of freedom yesterday, which spread across the land thanks to 35-year-old Judge Catherine Kimball Mizell of the Middle District of Florida, whose administrative law ruling on the mask mandate found that the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, had no authority to make such a command. Liberals are melting down at her nationwide injunction against this fascist order to throw a gag around your face on an airplane. Oh, it's beautiful. But what's more beautiful, besides the awakening of freedom, of facial liberty on aircraft and in airports, what's glorious is the liberal meltdown about it. Twitter blue checks are in a tizzy because now you don't have to walk around with an obedience gag around your pie hole. I love their tears, ladies and gentlemen. I wish to bathe in them. I wish to float on them. Oh, I'm just so happy. Now this is absolutely perfect ruling. Okay, look, I am a, as I said, a noted Los Angeles trial lawyer. I deal with federal judges on a fairly frequent basis, and I know how to read an opinion. This opinion was pretty darn good. The law which the CDC cited for its declaration that you have to stick a useless piece of paper around your face to get on an aircraft basically did not provide any kind of authority to the Center for Disease Control to actually make this decree. You know, it has control over sanitation, according to the law, 1944 law. Putting a mask on your face is not sanitation in any sense of the word. Now, there were some other bases for this, including administrative rulemaking problems. But, you know, after 2 years of this nonsense, and it's always been nonsense, there are few places that you are more objectively safe than on an airplane with its filters and such. But after 2 years of this nonsense, it goes to this judge. Now, she's a 35-year-old judge, okay? But she's pretty darn accomplished. She's been a clerk for four federal judges, including Judge Clarence Thomas. And, of course, the liberals are melting down about this, all right? But it gets better, folks. She's appointed by Donald Trump. She is confirmed in the lame duck session in 2020. To the Middle District of Florida. And she issues this nationwide injunction. Now, the liberals have been loving their nationwide injunctions. You remember the Florida judge. Not the Florida judge. The Hawaii judge. Right? Whenever they have a problem with some federal law or action that or federal, you know, thing that Donald Trump was doing, they go find some Hawaiian judge to issue a nationwide injunction. This is the most important, glorious thing that could ever happen. Well, welcome to the Florida judge. Now we got Florida judge. And they are melting. How can one judge do this? Yeah, how can she? New rules, baby. New rules. Oh, drink it in. I'm drinking it in. I'm drinking it in. And I think we have a future Supreme Court justice in Judge Mizell. I'm just saying. Look for when the murder turtle is running the Senate next year, because he will be running the Senate next year, in my humble opinion. We'll check with David Drucker and Byron York a little later to see if they concur that the Republicans will take the Senate. We know they're taking the House. House is done. House is over. Just, we're not even going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the Senate. But, you know, when with Mitch McConnell running the Senate and a Republican running things after 2024, because we know that's going to happen, because the Democrats are just screwing up left and right. And we're going to get to that in a sec. I think we're going to see Judge Mizell on the Circuit Court of Appeal. And I think someday she may well be on the Supreme Court. And I'd like to see her on at like age 40 so she can reign for 50 years of pain. Oh, I'm getting all tingly, folks. I'm getting all tingly at the thought of a conservative justice who doesn't hesitate to act. Now, I mentioned that the Democrats are screwing up. And, well, let's put it this way. Grandpa Badfinger, our crusty dust puppet of a president, is such a mess. He literally had to be rescued yesterday by the Easter Bunny. Well, it wasn't yesterday. It was a couple days ago. By the Easter Bunny. That's right. He made the mistake of like beginning a long, rambling soliloquy to the press at some Easter function. Some flunky in an Easter Bunny getup, you know, hops over, right? And he's like, come on, Mr. President, gotta go. Look, President Beavis is a mess. And look, Hugh Hewitt, who is a very nice guy, he's a genuinely nice human being, and he phrases it as the president is infirm. Yeah, that's one way of putting it. That's like saying a Ferrari is fast. Homeboy is a mess. I mean, he's literally being rescued from talking to the press by the Easter Bunny. Now, coming on the heels of him shaking hands with an invisible friend. There's nobody in charge. Now, Democrats are trying to fill the void. Chris Coons, who Hugh finds one of the less repellent Democrats. He's another Delaware guy like, President Krusty. Yeah, on Sunday, he goes on one of the shows and he says, you know, Russians aren't going to stop unless we go in and stop them. So yesterday we had the big tap dancing, No, I didn't mean we'd use U.S. troops. I didn't mean it. That's not what I'm saying. Dude, that was what you were saying. We heard you. You said it. This guy. These guys. They're a mess. Who's going to rescue the Democrats? Who's going to rescue them from themselves? You know, right now, Democrat Senate candidates, incumbents particularly, like the one in Nevada who's running against Adam Laxalt, who's going to win the primary there. Good friend of mine, worked with him and Rick Grinnell and Matt Schlapp and some other folks fighting for election integrity after the election. Cortez Masto, who I just saw a picture of her yesterday. She's like one of these anonymous bench warmers. You know, backbencher type. She's actually behind the backbench. She's on like a whole different set of benches that's somewhere off. She does literally nothing except obey Schumer. She's like terrified that President Krusty's going to lift Title 42, which allows us basically summary removal of illegal aliens. If we don't do that, we're going to start getting 200,000 illegal aliens a month. Oh, wait a minute. We already have that. Imagine 500,000 illegal aliens every month. She knows the people of Nevada aren't going to like it. Mark Kelly's sitting there going, you can see the sweat glistening on his bald, gun-grabbing head. Democrats are going to get wiped out in the Rio Grande Valley. Oh, that was all blue? They're going to get slaughtered. And I am here for it, and you're here for it. Here on the Hugh Hewitt Radio Program, I'm guest host Kurt Schlichter. We got 3 hours of insanity. Stick around. Wow. We're back. Back on the Hugh Hewitt Radio Program. Of course, that was William Shatner's legendary spoken word performance of Elton John's Rocket Man, which I think is extremely apt right now because we're talking about Elon Musk. Again, I'm guest host Kurt Schlichter, sitting in for Hugh Hewitt. And I'm known for being the author of the forthcoming book, We'll Be Back, The Fall and Rise of America, which you should pre-order, for being a noted trial lawyer in Los Angeles, for being a retired Army colonel, for being the senior columnist at townhall.com. But I think my greatest role is as a Twitter shareholder. And I've been very, very concerned about the antics of the board. So I went and I got an expert to tell us about this area of law, to explain what our rights are as shareholders in this fine, fine company. I grabbed my pal, Professor Todd Henderson, University of Chicago Law School, the Michael J. Marks Professor of Law and a securities expert. Professor Henderson, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Radio Program.
Colonel Schlichter, it's great to be here.
Well, it is great to have you. Now, I am a regular old school litigator. I know nothing of your fancy securities law. I took corporations in law school and promptly forgot about it as soon as I passed the California bar exam. Do I have any kind of rights? Because this board, you know, I'm losing out about $500 by them not taking this generous $54.20 offer by Elon Musk. I'm outraged, and more importantly, I'm impoverished. Do I have any rights as a shareholder of Twitter?
Well, you use the word fancy securities law, and you know, honestly, it's way too fancy and way too complex. And in general, my own view is it's way too protective of corporate managers. It really started not just in the New Deal, but in 1968 when a very corrupt senator from New Jersey, this guy named Senator Williams, passed a law that made it very difficult for people like Elon Musk to take over other corporations. All these obligations to have to disclose how much you have and what your plans are. You know, it's a little bit like telling people who are trying to come in and save the kingdom, they've got to disclose exactly what their war plans are before they do that. So the whole system is really rigged against people like Musk who are trying to take over companies to improve them. So, you know, that's a sort of starting position. But unfortunately, under the rules as they are, from what I've seen from the public reports has done, is pretty squarely within what their legal rights are to do.
Well, what they appear to have done, Professor Henderson, is Elon Musk obtained about a little over 9% of the company's stock, and he made an offer of $54.20 a share. It was trading at 48 yesterday. It was 45.08 on Friday. I watch the stock market like a hawk, and you know, there's a premium there. There's money on the table. I'm a shareholder. Silly me. I thought that the board was supposed to act in shareholder interests. I don't understand how it's shareholders' interest to not get me the maximum value for my stock.
Yeah, it's a good point. So first, I mean, one thing that I think to appreciate is that it's not at all clear that Musk has made a serious offer. Just because he, you know, his filing with the SEC said he hasn't really lined up the financing yet. And he said he's going to make that offer. So I just want to note at the outset that it's not exactly clear what the offer on the table is. And I think the fact that the stock price is still trading, you know, in the 40s suggests that Wall Street really doesn't believe that he's serious about the offer. But let's take for a second that he is serious about the offer. You're right that the board's job is to maximize shareholder value. And then the question is, what is the mechanism by which they can do that? the board adopted something called a poison pill, which it's complicated, but basically it just makes it impossible for Musk to take ownership of the company without the board's approval. And if what that's designed to do is to get him to make a better offer, then they might be working in shareholders' interest. So if they say to him, look, we've taken this poison pill, if you try to take us over, we'll just bite on this pill and kill the whole company, dilute your shares, and really prevent you from doing it. It's a kind of, you know...
And won't it dilute my shares, too?
Well, the way the poison pill works is that they only dilute the shares of the person trying to take over the company. So it's this trick developed by these New York lawyers. It's basically the, you know, it's like in Dr. Strangelove, you know, it's the bomb that happens that sort of kills everybody at the end, the doomsday bomb. And the idea is it never would be used. But it basically makes the board have incredible amounts of leverage for somebody who's trying to take over the company. So if the board did this and said to Musk, look, 54 isn't enough, we want to get 64, then that's something that would be actually in the shareholders' interest. You would prefer 64 to 54, I assume.
I'm no mathematician. Yeah. Just like KBJ was no biologist. But I think 64 is higher than 54.
Yeah. So what the board does is use this leverage to get a better deal for shareholders, then you'd be in favor of that. If what they do is they use the leverage to push Musk away and keep the stock at $45, then I think shareholders would rightly be upset. They unfortunately, under the current law, have pretty broad discretion to be able to do that. Now, what can you do as a shareholder? Well, you can sell your shares. You're going to get less than 54 right now. You're going to get 45 based on what you said. You can also vote in the corporate elections to get rid of this board and put in a board that would redeem the pill, get rid of this doomsday bomb that they have that would keep Musk away, and get in directors who will actually serve what are the shareholders' interests. And I think, frankly, the reason we're all talking about this is it's not just the shareholders' interest. There's a public interest in returning Twitter to something that is more sensible about, you know, kick off Donald Trump, but keep on the Iranian mullahs, let the Chinese put all the propaganda they want out there and censor all sorts of domestic politicians. I mean, I think that's the real fundamental issue. And what Musk is trying to do is return it to being the free speech that it was intended to do. I think we should all be in favor of that. Unfortunately, the way corporate law works, the board has a lot of discretion when it comes to takeovers.
Well, that, you know, Professor Henderson, and that's the problem. Look, these guys want money as much as anybody else. However, what's more important to them is maintaining the power that comes with controlling the public square. And the way they are controlling the public square in such a way as to ensure that counter-narrative information is suppressed, whether it's banning Donald Trump or banning the libs of TikTok or banning anybody else who rails against the regime. This is not about shareholder value. This is about the ruling class maintaining its control of the narrative and its power. And we all know it. And it seems to me that, perhaps the law doesn't allow a remedy, but boy, there ought to be a remedy. Do you expect to see any kind of shareholder lawsuits over this?
Well, I think the first thing to point out is that, as you said, this isn't really about shareholder value. Musk tweeted the other day the compensation of the board of directors, and they hold very, very few shares in
yes.
Twitter. And so they don't really, they're not aligned with you because the shareholders care about is turning their money into more money. And what the directors prefer is their own sinecure there with their four meetings a year and their fancy trips and the big compensation they get. And they're not really aligned with shareholders. So that's a problem. And Twitter should fix that. It's a problem in corporate America more generally. With respect to shareholder lawsuits, I doubt it based on what the current situation is. I'd love to see Musk make a more serious offer, line up the financing, and make a play. He could also launch a proxy battle to try to replace the board of directors, throw the bums out, and replace them with new managers. He has a lot of power as the largest shareholder, and I'd like to see him exercise that. Unfortunately, the way that corporate law is, again, since 1968, when this very pro-management, anti-shareholder, anti-activist shareholder, and since that law came in, it's much more difficult. And frankly, the Securities Exchange Commission is considering a variety of new rules designed to prevent corporate activism. And these activists, more generally, are the people who are pushing for changes in corporate America to break the stranglehold that boards have and managers have, serving things like the climate agenda and all these other things as opposed to shareholder value. Activists are really pushing to have corporate America focus on what it's supposed to be focusing on, which is making money for shareholders. And the Gensler SEC is doing what it can to try to squash activism more generally. So I think this is just one example of a broader trend against shareholder rights, which I think is distressing.
Well, Professor Henderson, the Republicans look likely to take the House and the Senate back. In 2024, with a little luck, we'll take the presidency away from this senile dust puppet masquerading as our chief executive. At that point, we will have the chance to do some legislation and get things back on track. What kind of legal reforms would you look for to address these problems? Because, frankly, I'm sick of corporate America being used as a vehicle for every commie, pinko, and leftist and their bizarre obsessions and fetishes. We got about 30 seconds.
So I think Senator Toomey just introduced some legislation. It was the Jobs Act 4.0, which contained a wide variety of pro-capital markets regulation. I'd love to see the Congress really nip the SEC in the bud and take away a lot of the power they have to promulgate things like climate disclosures, conflict mineral disclosures, pushing diversity in corporate boardrooms. There's a lot of things the SEC is doing which Congress can change by legislation. I'd love to see them do it as a first step.
Well, thank you, Professor Todd Henderson, University of Chicago, Michael J. Marks, Professor of Law. Check out his novels. He's a writer as well as a securities lawyer. And stick around here on the Hugh Hewitt Radio Program. I'm guest host Kurt Schlichter. We're back with David Drucker in just a moment. We are back on the Hugh Hewitt Radio Program, and that somber and somewhat menacing music can mean only one thing. It means that we're joined by David Drucker of the Washington Examiner, a senior correspondent there, and author of In Trump's Shadow. David, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Radio Program.
Good to be here, Hugh. Kurt.
Kurt! Yeah. I don't often get mistaken for Hugh Hewitt. He's a kind, gentle soul, and I'm Kurt Schlichter. So That's kind
it's
of
like
a difference.
I'm on autopilot. It's like I'm on autopilot sometimes.
Yeah,
I knew it was you, and I'm glad to be here.
Well, speaking of pilots, apparently pilots announced on aircraft last night that the mask mandate had been thrown out by an aggressive judge in the Middle District of Florida to wild cheers and celebrating by everybody except many of your compadres in the media. What do you and many other blue check Democrats as well? How do you think this mask mandate thing plays politically, and is it going to help or hurt the Democrats that they had to be dragged kicking and screaming to a pandemic reality?
Well, listen, all good questions, and I don't think that the public writ large is going to be upset that the mask mandate has been struck down. You know, the political parties, I mean, everybody loves a so-called aggressive activist judge as long as they're doing what they want. And, you know, everybody bemoans legislating from the bench when they don't like the legislation. But I don't think this ultimately affects the political atmosphere all that much, other than to say is that President Biden has always been, not in the first few months of his presidency, where his leadership of the pandemic was pretty well regarded, across the political spectrum. But as people have started to become a little less patient with pandemic era restrictions, President Biden has been particularly in a difficult place for this reason. His political base there's nothing he can do that is aggressive enough in terms of maintaining or furthering pandemic era restrictions and regulations that is good enough for them, for his base. And yet, for many rank and file Democrats, people who voted for him, will still vote for him again. they're vaccinated and they want to be able, them and their kids, they want to be able to get back to a semblance of a normal life, not a completely normal life. And so for independent voters and for many rank and file Democrats, you know, things have remained a little bit too restrictive. Things have moved too slow. And yet for his base, even where he has inched towards normalcy, not only is that not good enough for them, they would prefer that he, in a sense, double down, if you will, and push further in the old direction. So all of this recovery, should theoretically benefit the president, but it never makes his base happy. And there are lots of things you can say about Biden's political predicament that are his fault, that he caused, that he continues to cause. This, to my mind, has never been one of them. He's just caught between a rock and a hard place, and I don't even know how you solve that.
Well, it couldn't happen to a crustier guy. Let's move on, David Drucker, to something that happened yesterday. Taylor Lorenz, this obnoxious fake 20-year-old, I think she's like 39 or something, but she pretends to be 25, from the Washington Post, was on TV a little while ago crying because of her PTSD, because people were mean to her on Twitter. And now she's out doxing somebody, known as Liberals of TikTok. And Liberals of TikTok's crime is posting TikTok videos of weirdos, losers, and mutations with piercings and blue hairs, bragging about essentially how they're grooming children and doing other weird things. And Liberals of TikTok wants to be anonymous because the left wants to destroy anybody who fights the regime media. Now, you are among other people in the press. You are not necessarily one of the leftists, but do the mainstream regime media reporters understand fully how much we hate them when they do things like that? And I don't mean just dislike them. I mean, wish them active ill.
I don't know. I mean, it's not that, I understand the complaints about, the mainstream media, so-called, even though I consider myself a part of the mainstream media. When I got into journalism after a brief career in sales and marketing, I got into it in part because I thought I wanted to do it differently, because I saw that things weren't always done the way I would like as a news consumer. But, this sort of thing, doesn't happen all that often. I think the larger story here, what I will say about this is, I've always felt, and I mean, look, I like attention as much as anybody, and that's just the truth. One of the things I like about this job is I get a byline and I get to come on the radio.
Hey, I'm a lawyer. I know what you mean. Hey, we only got about 15 seconds.
But I don't like to be the story. And I think it would be better for all of us if we were not the story, that the people we were writing about remained the story. That is all.
Well, David Drucker of the Washington Examiner, you're the author of In Trump's Shadow. I think everybody should go out and get that. I wanted to ask you, should Trump be primaried in 2024 to help him? And we don't have time. We could go on for hours with David Drucker. I'm sure we'll talk to him next week when I guest host on Tuesday. Stick around. We got a lot more to come. This is Kurt Schlichter.
I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home, or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172.
It's a real pleasure to introduce my next guest. You guys know him. You love him. He's here every week. Byron York of the Washington Examiner, its chief political consultant and a Fox News contributor. Good morning, Byron.
Good morning, Kurt. Good to be here.
Okay, Byron, let's jump right into it. Yesterday, age indeterminate adolescent Taylor Lorenz of the Washington Post has tried to dox the anonymous account known as Libs of TikTok. Libs of TikTok's crime is showing TikTok videos of weirdos, losers, and mutations with blue hair and piercings, in large part talking about how they want to groom children in our schools. This person, of course, now must be destroyed, according to our ruling class. My question to you, Byron York, because you, though you are not necessarily one of them, you are among the mainstream media. Does the mainstream media, the regime media, as it were, understand how much normal people hate them for garbage like this?
No, I don't think so. This is part actually of a much bigger story, which is the suppression of free speech and expression on the internet. The Babylon Bee, a very funny website, is still off. Their main Twitter account is still off. Twitter is having been suspended apparently indefinitely until they remove a tweet that Twitter found offensive. And so this is a small part. Taylor Lorenz is kind of a headline seeker who has worked at the nation's most prestigious journalistic organizations, although I predict that she'll probably get out of those at some point.
Well, I think Taylor Lorenz is doing incredible damage to the media and those like her. They have zero credibility. I don't think that the regime media fully understands how much normal Americans, particularly conservative Americans, actively hate the media. And I use the word hate advisedly. I'm not trying to be hyperbolic. We despise them. We want to cause them harm. We celebrate when a newspaper goes under, and it's all because of what they have done.
Well, you just said earlier that I was part of this.
But not in it.
Celebrate when a newspaper or a journalistic organization goes under. I just don't. I think it's a bad idea. I think mockery of something like a person like Taylor Lorenz is entirely appropriate. There's a lot of it on the internet. So that's as far as I would go with it. I think the question of bias just goes so much deeper than the antics of Taylor Lorenz and this whole doxing stuff. I mean, the question of bias, I mean, there have been people in the conservative movement who've done sort of heroic work against bias for decades, going back to a man named Reed Irvine many years ago.
I remember.
Bozell and the Media Research Center and now Newsbusters have done really great work pointing this out year after year, and they started doing it back in the days when there were three network newscasts, and that was it, ABC, CBS, NBC, and then the Washington Post and the New York Times, which is a vastly worse time, in my opinion, in our media history than today, where you have this just incredible array and choice of information available to you. To tell you the truth, I think we're in a much better situation today than we were in, say, 1965, 1975, when there were those two newspapers, New York Times, Washington Post, three networks, ABC, CBS, NBC. All of them were headquartered within a few blocks of each other in Manhattan, and they all read each other and made the same decisions every day, and you didn't have a choice, and you didn't have access to primary documents. If some judge makes a decision, you can now go on the internet and read it, and it takes a little extra effort, but you can do that. And like when a newspaper publishes a story about a poll, I never read the story. I click on the poll and look at the poll. That's something you can do in this media age that you couldn't do in a previous one. So, forgive me for being positive here, but even with the ridiculous sort of stuff around Taylor Lorenz, we're in a far, far better position than we were, decades ago.
Well, Byron York, I think those are actually very good points. And as angry as we're getting about the repression and attacks on free speech, the internet has provided us with opportunities to, as you say, reach those primary sources, and to there are now avenues for getting around the gatekeepers, like the Hugh Hewitt radio program. Let me move on to something that I found both hilarious and deeply, deeply frightening. A couple things happened in the last 2 days that I think are very scary. Chris Coons, a very prominent Democrat from Delaware, went on a Sunday morning show and essentially said, you know, the United States ought to intervene in Ukraine. At the same time, our president was out on the White House lawn attempting to talk to the press, and someone dressed as the Easter Bunny came and shooed him away. So we both have a push among some in the Democratic Party for essentially war with the Soviet Union. At the same time, we have a president who is manifestly in decline. Are people in Washington concerned about the condition of this guy and his ability to be influenced by the short-sighted people around him?
Yeah, the answer is yes. And what you're saying, Senator Coons, Chris Coons, the Democratic senator from Delaware, President Biden's home state, is known to be very close, thought to be the closest Senate ally of the president, was even referred to as a shadow secretary of state in one profile of Politico last year. And, you know, before the Russians invaded Ukraine, when they were building up around Ukraine, Coons was strongly against the use of U.S. troops. And what happened in Ukraine, and what happened last week, he gave a speech to the University of Michigan, and he said that we're in a Cuban Missile Crisis hour. And then he kind of mixed his historical references. Then he said, we're in a 1939 moment. Each time he was saying that we're very, very close.
Do these people speak only in cliches or? I mean, it's embarrassing.
Yeah, there could be a handbook for this. But basically, he says, we're going to face a situation very, very soon in which we will need to send U.S. troops into Ukraine.
Oh,
and that
geez.
Putin will only stop if we stop him. So basically, Chris Coons has come out in favor of using U.S. troops in Ukraine. And since he is so influential with the president, and then that brings in what you talked about, the president's capabilities at this moment. You know, the Easter Bunny moment was funny, but it
terrifying.
Was concerning. But it was also concerning because of all the other concerns that we've had with the president's abilities right now. And I think that you can overstate it. You know, there are Republicans or conservatives who during the campaign said, oh, he's got dementia and he doesn't even know where he is. Well, he had just participated in 11 Democratic debates in their primary contest. So that was crazy. On the other hand, he's going to be 80 later on this year. He's by far the oldest president we've ever had. He's visibly, obviously slowing down. And what you worry about with a president like that, who is slowing down, is that ambitious other aides will be able to have room to operate in the absence, in the vacuum created by a president who is not fully able. So that is something that's of real concern.
Well, it's of real concern to me, and I object to the pronoun we that Coons used. Coons not going to fight in Ukraine. The students at University of Michigan are not going to fight in Ukraine. The troops that I led, they're going to do the fighting in Ukraine, and I'm not buying it, and we're not having it. This is Kurt Schlichter, guest hosting for the great Hugh Hewitt. Stick around. We got a lot more to come.
Colonel Kurt Schlichter, take it away.
I do love it, Hugh Hewitt. This is Kurt Schlichter, guest hosting in the Relief Factor studio in beautiful Southern California. You know me as senior columnist for townhall.com, retired United States Army colonel. What else am I? Noted a Los Angeles trailer, author of the upcoming Regnery book. We'll be back, The Fall and Rise of America, which you should go pre-order at Barnes & Noble or Amazon or wherever fine books are purveyed. Got an election coming up. A big one in which we are going to take back the United States Senate. Now, it's a pretty safe Republican seat in Oklahoma, but it's the primary that we're concerned with. And I've got a candidate for you. His name is Alex Gray. He's worked in the National Security Council with what I think is the best national security advisor ever, Robert O'Brien. He's a friend of the show. Alex Gray, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Radio Program.
Hey, good morning, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Let's jump right to it. You want to join the United States Senate for reasons that escape me. And you will be in with the likes of Chris Coons, the senator from Delaware, who this weekend said, although he now denies it, essentially, yeah, we've got to intervene in Ukraine and fight the Russians with troops on the ground. What the hell?
Yeah. Well, look, it's insanity. No one wants to send American men and women to go fight in Ukraine.
Well, he does.
no thinking person wants to do that. And unfortunately, I think we've got too many unthinking people in Washington and in our Congress. But look, Kurt, you know this as well as anyone. We've got a crisis in Ukraine that has been caused for a large part by the weakness of the Biden administration. They failed to deter what President Trump was able to deter for 4 years. And you know, we were able, in the administration that I served, we were able to do sensible things like provide Javelin anti-tank missiles, provide training, and all the sorts of things that you do when you have a vested interest in making sure that aggression doesn't stand. But at the same time, President Trump always understood that American interests, while they certainly stood with the Ukrainian people, our interests did not stand with having American boots on the ground or anything of that nature in Eastern Europe. And, you know, President Trump kept his eye on the ball. And as you know, Kurt, the ball, the biggest threat we face is the Communist Party of China. And that's where our attention should be focused. And obviously, there's a huge connection here between what happens in Eastern Europe, what happens in Ukraine and Taiwan and the Taiwan Strait. But one thing that Xi Jinping is sitting in Beijing hoping we do is get ourselves bogged down in Eastern Europe for decades like we were in the Middle East. To him, that would be the greatest possible strategic victory. And unfortunately, Senator Coons seems inclined to hand that to the CCP.
Well, Alex Gray, the Republican Party has changed somewhat in the last 20 years. There used to be a stereotype of Republicans as reflexive hawks. Of course, that's very different from the Republicans of the 20s and 30s. But we have changed. And look, I'm not a pacifist, but having served overseas twice, I do understand the importance of making sure that the wars we're involved in and the conflicts that we stick our toes into are ones that support America's national interests. As a senator, hopefully you will be called upon to declare war. And unfortunately, we have not declared war since World War II. Instead, we've kind of had these ad hoc conflicts that always seem to end badly. What is your personal test for when America should commit the lives and treasure of the American people?
You know, I think it's amazing how in Washington, it's obviously war and peace are complicated issues, but somehow folks in Washington think tanks and the D.C. establishment have managed to turn the question of war and peace into something that I think most Oklahomans can give you a pretty straightforward answer to. It's whether this is in the national interest of the United States or not, whether to use force, whether it is in the national security interests of the people of the United States. And you go to any county in Oklahoma, and they can pretty simply give you a straightforward answer. Is it in the national security interest of the United States for us to be engaged in a protracted ground conflict in Ukraine? I think, you know, you go talk to 100 people in any county of any of our 77 counties, probably 99, if not all 100 of them, are going to be able to tell you pretty quickly, no, that's not in our interests. But at the same time, Kurt, we've got a lot of people in Washington who like to create these false dichotomies. They like to say, well, you must be an isolationist if you don't want to go and be involved in nation building, if you don't want to go be involved in protracted conflicts in far, far distant parts of the world. It's not that it really doesn't have to be teed up that way. You know, the way I look at it, Kurt, the United States has an interest in peace. We have an interest in preserving the territorial integrity of countries. We have an interest in sending a signal to China that they're not going to be allowed to take over countries like Taiwan without, they're not going to be allowed to change the map of the world by force. That's kind of a key pillar of what makes the modern world work. But that doesn't mean that we have to make investments in building countries, building democracies, the failed policies of the last 30 years. So I think a lot of this is our false choices that the D.C. swamp have teed up for us.
Well, Alex Gray, running for Senate in the great state of Oklahoma, a great military state. I did my basic training at Fort Sill back in the day, that day being, oh my gosh, 35 years ago this December. Look, leadership, and I'm a retired United States Army colonel, leadership is about making choices and setting priorities. And not, you know, territorial integrity, very important. I think in Desert Storm, the invasion of Kuwait, it was in America's interest to throw the Iraqis out of Kuwait. I was part of 7th Corps that did that. I was a small and unimportant part of 7th Corps where I washed trucks, but I was there nonetheless. On the other hand, here in Ukraine, yes, the Russians have taken Ukrainian territory. I still don't think it's important enough for Americans to intervene. For one thing, I can't think of an end state, and I never hear that from the likes of a Chris Coons. What is the end state? What state are we fighting for at the end? When do we know we've won? And I think it's important that we articulate those things. As a senator, how are you going to help some of the Republicans who, frankly, reflexively go back to the old unthinking hawk ways? I'd much rather you be a thinking hawk than the other kind. How are you going to help them, using your experience at the National Security Council, to analyze these problems so when called upon to vote for war or peace, that they can do it with some skill and clarity?
You know, President Trump, Kurt, I think taught us a lot of important lessons, but one that I think applies pretty usefully to questions of war and peace is the maxim that he often said, which was economic security is national security. And one of the ways that the president made decisions about how to use American strength was also in the context of our economic strength. And, you know, I'm not one of these people that says, you know, the false dichotomy of we should only be nation building at home, that we should be focused entirely on what goes on within our coasts. We shouldn't be focused on things that go on abroad. That's a false choice. What happens overseas certainly affects the United States and affects our people. That being said, we've got to ask ourselves, at a time of record inflation, at a time of a slowing economy, at a time of really profound challenges at home that mostly have been brought about by the Biden administration's policies, we have to ask ourselves, what are the fundamental threats and challenges that we're facing? And I would argue right now, Kurt, We've got to be thinking about the economy. We've got to be thinking, what are the greatest economic challenges that we should be facing? Certainly, it's regaining energy independence. It's not focusing on, it's certainly not putting American boots on the ground in Ukraine.
Alex Gray, we only have a few seconds left. How can we help you if we want to get you into the Senate, bring some of that expertise from Donald Trump's very successful National Security Council to our Senate?
You can go to my website, alexgrayforsenate.com. We'll be grateful for everyone's support. And if you live in Oklahoma, June 28th is our primary.
Alex Gray running for Senate. Give him a look. And we are back with the Smiths as our bumper music. How soon is now? In honor of Ed Morrissey, who will be guest hosting here on the Hugh Hewitt radio program tomorrow before I, Kurt Schlichter, author of We'll Be Back, The Fall and Rise of America, which you should go pre-order right now. I will be back on Thursday with a lot more stuff. A very, very important article that you guys may have missed. It's in Tablet Magazine. Biden Koshers Iranian Terror by Michael Doran, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. I recommend you go read it. And we're joined by Michael Doran now. Michael, thanks for being here on the Hugh Hewitt radio program.
Good morning. Great to be here. Nice to talk to you in person. I've enjoyed your spirited commentary for a long time now.
Well, that's the nicest euphemism that's been used about me in quite some time. No, I really admire this article, Biden Kosher's Iranian Terror, because I think it brings up their strategy in the Biden administration of trying to cover up what is an atrocious betrayal of our country and of our ally Israel. Can you give us a summation of your thesis?
The summation of the thesis in one sentence is that there's no Iranian aggression that this administration regards as a national security threat. They only regard it as a public relations challenge. So, you know, when they the Iranians, while they're negotiating the return to the nuclear deal, the Iranians tried to kidnap an Iranian American journalist in Brooklyn, and they were going to kill her, presumably. And it barely made the news. It barely made the news. I mean, if you're negotiating with another country and they try to kidnap somebody from your country at that moment, that's the time to take a stand. And that's one example. I can give you 20.
Well, there's another great example right now. The Iranians are targeting former Trump administration officials, including Mike Pompeo and others who now need protection. And this is intolerable. I don't understand how our government tolerates that, even though they may not be of the same party. Who's the enemy, the Iranians or the Republicans?
You know, the funniest thing about that story or stories is that the Biden administration knew that the Iranians had open plots to kill Pompeo, his deputy Brian Hook, and John Bolton. All this is revenge for the killing of Qasem Soleimani, and they continued to negotiate. And at a certain point, information about those plots leaked out to the press, and then the press started asking the administration questions. And then it got embarrassing for the administration. So then the administration goes to the Iranians and says, hey, we're getting kind of embarrassed with this story that you're going to kill American officials and we're about to hand hundreds of billions of dollars to you. Can you give us a fig leaf? Will you at least commit to us that you'll turn off those plots? And the Iranians said no.
You know, here, look. You know, I'm only a retired Army colonel and a Los Angeles trial lawyer who does some bit of negotiation. I would have had a different counteroffer, Michael Doran. I would have said, well, you know, you can have your plots against us, but you understand if you do any of that, we'll kill everybody you ever met, starting with you. And perhaps that would have worked a little better.
That's common sense, but this is the thing. One of the reasons why I wrote the article is that there's a whole body of analysis of the Biden administration out there saying that they are bad negotiators. They see that they're giving away things during the negotiations. For example, they're not doing anything to enforce the sanctions on the oil sales of the Iranians to China, and so tons of money, even under sanctions right now, is pouring into Iran. Thereby releasing them from the pressure to actually negotiate. So a body of analysis says, well, the Biden team, they're really bad negotiators. But I think we need to wake up. They're not negotiating. This is a fire sale. They are in full-blown appeasement mode. And it's bigger than the Iran deal. The Iran deal is the instrument by which they're appeasing. But they're appeasing anyway, all the time.
Well, Michael Doran, why? We're in the catbird seat. We have the military power. We have the economic power. We have the diplomatic power. We have the information power. We should be dictating to these mullahs, who incidentally have already killed many hundreds of Americans in Iraq and have not had payback. Why are we playing footsies with these guys at all? I don't understand it.
There's two reasons. They have a foreign policy theory. And the foreign policy theory is that it's our allies, Israel and Saudi Arabia, that are throwing us into conflict with Iran. That, in objective terms, the United States and Iran don't have that much to quarrel about. And so if we can restrain the allies and then just start negotiating with the Iranians directly over the heads of the allies. That's the way to stabilize the Middle East. That's their theory.
Even though the Abraham Accords have done more to stabilize the Middle East than any other development in the last half century.
Totally. I mean, the amazing thing with the Abraham Accords is that the next step with the Abraham Accords was some kind of normalization. I don't know if it was going to be full-blown peace, but a dramatic public improvement of relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel.
Yes.
So you've got Saudi Arabia, the country that all Muslims pray toward five times a day, and is going to make peace with the Jewish state. That has significance for the relations not just between Jews and Muslims, but between Christians and Muslims, the West and
yes.
the Middle East, everything. And that was within reach because of the Abraham Accords. And the Biden administration turned its back on that and instead decided to empower the worst regime in the region that is aligned with all of the worst elements in the region. It's insane.
Well, Michael Doran, I think it indicates the incredible parochialism of our ruling class. I'm just a simple suburban soldier guy, but I lived overseas 5 years and I spent time in the Middle East. I've actually experienced some of this. What I see with these people, Michael Doran, is this incredible condescension. An incredible misunderstanding. They don't actually think the mullahs believe what the mullahs believe. They're actually disrespecting the Iranians by thinking, well, you know, this apocalyptic Shia nonsense. They don't really believe that. Just like we don't really believe this, religion stuff here. We mouth it at election time, but yeah, we really don't believe it. We're past that. We're secular folks. The Iranians. Believe in their faith, a twisted and bizarre version of Islam, but they believe it nonetheless. And our garbage ruling class doesn't understand that other people don't think exactly like they do.
You kind of have to give it to the Iranians here, because when the administration turned to them and said, "Will you at least give us a pinky promise that you won't kill our officials?" They said no. They didn't even bother to lie. There was a little bit of honor in that, I guess. But I totally agree with you, Kurt, about that. There's nothing more parochial than a cosmopolitan American. It's just amazing. And it comes from what you said. It's condescension toward Americans. That's where it starts, because they're in their minds, they're always showing themselves in the world that they're more sophisticated than the average American. And it's one of the reasons they grab this doctrine, the saying that the allies are the problem in the Middle East, is because it's nonsensical as a foreign policy doctrine, but it's good domestic politics inside the progressive bubble. Because what it does is it says that all of the bad guys in the progressive world, the people that the progressives hate anyway, so that's evangelical Christians, security-minded Republicans like yourself and me, Bibi Netanyahu, Mohammed bin Salman. That's the party of war. Those are the bad guys. They're creating all the problems in the world. And the Iranians, well, they're not the good guys necessarily, but they're the objects of diplomacy. And we, being more sophisticated and more cosmopolitan, and just more worldly than the rubes in America, we know how to go cut a deal with these nasty bastards over there. That's the way they're thinking.
Well, and it's baffling to me, because if you look at the track record of our foreign policy elite, it's a complete disaster. I mean, a total disaster since the Gulf War, which I participated in as a small and insignificant cog washing trucks out in the middle of the Saudi Arabia desert. Between the Gulf War and the building of that alliance and the ejection of Saddam Hussein from Kuwait and the Trump administration, that little interregnum of success, it has been nothing but failure after failure after failure. And, and it seems the more that our foreign policy elite fails, particularly in the Middle East, the more arrogant it becomes. It's actually kind of remarkable.
Well, we've got an enormous amount of power. We still have, despite all the mistakes, an enormous amount of power. I mean, that's what one of the things that I really appreciated about Donald Trump was that with respect to Iran, I mean, the one thing that Trump understands, every interaction he's engaged with, he always asks, who's winning? Who's on top, me or the other guy?
Yes.
And so that's the way Middle Easterners think.
Yes.
And so he looked at Iran and he thought, Iran, impoverished third world country, the United States superpower, we don't actually have to take them on their own terms. We can set the terms of the debate. And so he killed Qasem Soleimani, which was the right thing to do with him.
It absolutely was. Michael Doran, your article in Tablet Magazine, Biden koshers the Iran deal, is an amazing article. Tablet Magazine, Michael Doran, D-O-R-A-N. Check it out. Thank you for being on the Hugh Hewitt radio program.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.